The following podcast contains strong language and adult themes and is intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Heineke Digital presents The Mark. Who's Afraid? An audiobook podcast by Christian Heineke. Chapter 1. Moonlit Skies. For Caroline. Always. Again and again. The Reign of the Animals has begun. Albert Camus, 1939.
Prologue.
The floor and walls of the Junkers K-45 cargo hold vibrated with the roar of the engine, a soothing rhythm that gradually helped Wilhelm Korber relax. It was hard to believe they had achieved their goal. He had always been confident in his theory, but he never imagined he would validate it on the very first expedition to Alaska. If all went well, they would land in Seward in a few hours. From that small port, a long journey back to Germany awaited them, marking their final farewell to this frozen wasteland at the edge of the world. Korber's limbs ached, and his toes and fingertips still felt numb from the cold. He looked forward to returning to civilization and longed for a hot bath. The stench around them was unbearable. Equipment and clothing were musty and damp, carrying the odor of the sled dogs chained at the back of the hold. Another foul smell reached him from the bow. Althen sat by one of the small windows, staring into the icy distance, contemplating whether to light one of his foul-smelling cigars. Everyone celebrated their success in their own way. Korber opened the narrow steel box where he kept his notebook and began a new entry. November 13, 1936. Success. After all the hardships and Eisner's departure, we are now on our way back to the Reich. Our cargo is in the best of health. He glanced at the box, which measured about a meter and a half in width, height, and depth, adorned with the Imperial Eagle on its side. The contents of the crate filled Korber with satisfaction. Although not everything had gone as he had envisioned, the result mattered most. The girl was awake. Her skin was dark and her hair was snow white. He estimated her to be around 12 years old, peering through one of the small holes they had drilled in the top third of the crate to prevent her from suffocating. Her dark eyes met his with a probing, emotionless gaze. She shared a certain wildness with Althen, he thought.
Well, is it behaving? Althen asked, suddenly appearing next to him.
Korber jumped in surprise, trying to mask his reaction, but the satisfied grin on Althen's face suggested otherwise.
Why so nervous? Althen patted him on the shoulder. In Berlin, they'll celebrate us as heroes.
We'll see. And I'm not nervous at all. To prove his point, he closed the cassette and his notebook, but Althen continued to grin.
Well, in that case, Professor.
Althen took his cigar stub, poked it through one of the crate's holes, and pressed the embers onto the girl's skin. She howled in pain, her cry resembling that of an animal. Korber recoiled at the smell of burnt flesh, disgust etched on his face.
Are you insane? He yelled, jumping up to assess the damage.
What? Althen shrugged. If the beast is what you think it is, it won't mind. Think of it as a little test.
To his own surprise, Korber held his ground against Althen's challenging stare.
I guess you still don't realize what we have here, do you?
Kerber's face flushed crimson. Althen glanced at the girl.
A smelly Indian cunt?
His cold water blue eyes scrutinized Korber as he toyed with something in his gloved hand. Korber quickly snatched it away.
Where did you get that?
Althen simply gestured to the crate with a nod.
Had it with her.
Korber studied him. She wore it around her neck. He examined the item. A stone amulet on the leather band.
The stone appeared unremarkable, a polished hematite shaped like a star, its points connected by fine white lines carved into the surface. Why did you take it from her? He looked back at the crate. For the first time, the girl displayed a human emotion. She smiled, cradling the burned spot on her skin. This item looked too Jewish to me. Korber was incredulous at Alfin's ignorance and shook his head. God, Alfin, that's a pentagram, a pentagonal star. A Star of David is hexagonal. Did this fool truly believe a Native American girl would wear a Jewish symbol? Angrily, he held the amulet in front of Alfin. The latter's face remained impassive. I absolutely know the difference between a pentagram and a Star of David. But do you really want to risk that the Reichsfuhrer, or worse, our beloved Fuhrer himself, might misinterpret it? He opened his hand and waited. Alfin was right. The risk of misinterpretation was too high, especially at such elevated levels. They had already pushed their luck with this operation, and he thought of Eisner. With a sigh, he handed the talisman back to Alfin, who snatched it and tucked it discreetly into his breast pocket. Suddenly, a whimper emanated from the crate, prompting both men to exchange worried glances before rushing to look inside. The white-haired girl lay on the ground, writhing in agony, while the sled dogs began barking and yelping, straining against their chains in a frenzy. What the hell is going on here? Korber thought, but he could deal with the dogs later. She's collapsing, we can't lose her. He frantically searched for something to open the box. Making a quick decision, he grabbed one of the tent poles from a tied bundle of equipment nearby and used it as a crowbar to pry open one of the nailed boards. He felt Althin's hand yank him back. Are you out of your mind? Remember what that thing did to Eisner. With a swift motion, Korber freed himself from Althin's grip. That was during a full moon, you idiot. Help me, for crying out loud. Korber pried open the box. The girl continued to writhe in agony, her eyes twisted and glowing in the dim light of the hold. We are going to lose her, he thought, lifting the first heavy board from the top of the crate. We were so close, it can't end like this. Not like this. Moonlight seeped through the clouds, bathing the forest in a pale silver glow, but the little boy paid no attention. He was bleeding and running for his life. His name was Bjorn Eggert, and he was 6 years old. His brown hair had always been the envy of Mrs. Muller, the woman who cut it. Bjorn remembered how she would stroke his hair after each trim, gazing at his reflection in the large mirror beside the chattering women who gossiped with their hairdressers about the latest trivialities of the town. Most of the time, Mrs. Muller's eyes were on Bjorn's mother, who sat under a dryer hood, flipping through a magazine with a colorful cover announcing the birth of a noblewoman's beautiful baby. Eventually, his mother caught Mrs. Muller's gaze, looked up and smiled, as only a proud, attractive, not too old mother could. Such beautiful hair, the boy. So beautiful, Mrs. Muller would sigh. Bjorn's mother had explained to him that she couldn't have any more children. He didn't fully understand what that meant, but he sensed that Mrs. Muller was especially kind to him for that reason. Now, however, Bjorn's hair was not as nice or clean as usual. It glistened with a mix of sweat and snow. Panic surged within him as he desperately tried to evade the evil that hunted him. His narrow chest ached from running, and his lungs burned with effort. Panting, he expelled little white clouds into the winter night, imagining himself as the enchanted toy locomotive from one of his storybooks. He wore only dirty underwear and a pair of small tan socks that had once been white, now stained and wet from the snow. The print of Bart Simpson on a skateboard was barely visible. His bright yellow face faded to sepia. Bjorn felt he could go no further. His body had reached its limits. He might not make it. He needed to rest for a moment. He stopped and listened, hearing only his own panting and the pounding of his heart. Was there another sound? The dry scrape of claws on snow, perhaps? No, only the soft sound of snowflakes falling. He couldn't remember the last time November had brought this much snow to Lüneburg. Everything felt wrong. Christmas was only weeks away. He wished for a Lego set, and maybe an iPod Touch. But his mother had warned him that Santa would bring less than usual this year. She called it a crisis, and he felt it must be serious if it limited Santa's abilities. Was there a growl? No. He looked around. He stood at the foot of a small hill, where a trellis of slender birch trees opened into a clearing. Nothing looked familiar. In his childlike faith, he didn't realize that without a landmark, even an experienced scout could get lost in the forest. He hoped he had been here before, wandering the woods near the old English military training grounds in search of cool finds like bullet casings or old practice grenades. His mother, of course, knew nothing of these adventures. She didn't want him playing in the woods with his friends, and Santa punished naughty children. Everyone knew that. He had to continue. He had to. He ran up the hill and stumbled into a snow-covered rabbit hole entrance. His left foot hit the hole, and a terrible pain shot up his leg from his ankle. He fell forward onto his face, tasting warm blood mingling with snow and earthy forest soil. He had bitten his tongue. Standing up, he spat a warm glob of pink saliva into the pristine white. A scent caught his attention, igniting a troubling association. It smelled like Captain Iglis's fish sticks in a cold pan, but this odor was older, more rancid, and more sinister. Then he heard a growl behind him. It unmistakably belonged to an animal, but not just any animal. This was an ancient creature that seemed to have roamed the earth for ages, so evil it belonged only in fairy tales. But it was real, and it was trailing just behind him. Bjorn's teeth chattered, not from the cold, but from fear. His bladder threatened to empty, but there was nothing worth the effort. Desperately, he tried to pull his leg out of the rabbit hole. He looked up the hill. The moon shone down, bright and indifferent. A sharp pain shot up his spine as claws tore at his back. A sudden wave of warmth washed over him. He didn't scream. It didn't hurt at all. Stunned, he stared at the pool of his own blood steaming in the cold snow. The evil tossed him around, and the last thing he saw was its glowing eyes, cold as the stars and the full moon above him. Then massive teeth sank into his throat, and he felt fur tickling his cheeks. Such beautiful hair. So beautiful.
Ruth Marks found it amusing how calm the first shift with a new colleague could be after knocking out a tooth. Despite her four-wheel drive, she struggled to keep the heavy VW Touareg steady on the dark, icy road. Beside her, Ulbrich appeared shaken, but she felt little sympathy for him. She had known him for only half a day. With her previous colleague, it had taken over 2 months before she had to defend herself against a sexual assault. New high score, she thought. He had been making increasingly inappropriate suggestions all day, culminating 5 minutes ago when he placed his hand on her thigh and made a foolish remark. Ruth was not surprised that such behavior still occurred in the German police force in the 21st century. She loved her job and had no desire to challenge the outdated structures within the department. But when a rookie like Ulbrich crossed her, it cost him a tooth. Because of her fierce reputation, her colleagues dubbed her Red Ruth. She didn't particularly like her red hair, which she always tied back in a ponytail. She thought her lips were too thin, and her eyes too close together. However, her appearance likely fit the prey pattern of the average Lower Saxony policeman. Behind closed doors, the boys had various nicknames for her. While it was not uncommon for policewomen to have romantic relationships with other women, not everyone embraced it wholeheartedly. It certainly didn't help that Ruth was 3 times the cop most of her fellow officers were. As the car veered off course, Ruth tried to focus on the road ahead but couldn't resist a quick glance at the distress beside her. Peter Ulbrich was fixated on the road, his right hand pressing a paper handkerchief to the edge of his split lip.
"Was that really necessary?"
he asked, staring into the void illuminated by their headlights. Ruth didn't respond. "Okay, you're a professional. Show him that."
"How much?" she asked. "What?" Ulbrich, with his one-track mind, had expected an answer, not a question. Ruth sighed. The game was always the same. How much did the guys bet you that Red Ruth enjoys flirting with her new partner? Ulbrich looked at her, horrified. A small red stain had formed on his handkerchief. He fell silent, his swollen lower lip jutting out slightly, recalling his stoic Lower Saxon ancestry. But the flush on his cheeks told Ruth everything she needed to know. Ulbrich had God sighed and turned on the radio. On NDR 90.3,
The early Beatles were singing Mr. Moonlight. Ruth immediately felt uneasy. Crap. She had moved on from the Beatles long ago. Change the channel, she demanded. Now what? I can't stand the Beatles, okay? That was as close as she would get to addressing the subject. Who doesn't like the Beatles? Ulbrich asked. Ruth simply stared at him. All right, he grumbled, tapping the button for the next station, FFN. They played something by the Bangles. Better. Not great, but better. The blue ghost light of the emergency vehicles flickered through the white and black lattice of birch trees, reflecting 100 times in the drops on the windshield. The wipers, set to interval, swept them away. Ruth noticed a flurry of activity at the scene where they had discovered the body. The hurried faces of the responders stirred feelings in her that she thought she had buried long ago. Something was off here. She could almost sense it. I want to apologize. Ulbrich paused, crumpling the handkerchief in his hands. I'm not usually like this. The boys said... He fell silent. Maybe there was hope for him after all. We'll talk later, Ulbrich. She turned off the engine. They exited the car and Ruth glanced at the position of the pool balls on the table.
Having worked in the homicide unit, Ruth had learned to view a crime scene as a complex arrangement on a pool table. The perpetrator had taken his shot. Now it was her task to interpret the clues and deduce how the crime had been committed. From there, she could determine the nature of the perpetrator. Ruth scanned the area for Ulbrich and spotted him just as he punched Schmidt on the shoulder in anger. Schmidt grinned in response, while Mensching made a macho gesture. Ulbrich simply stared at them before stomping away. Ruth was about to approach the men when Heiner Enke stepped into her path. Clearly, he was the investigating detective. God help us. Ruth had hoped for a quick glimpse of the crime scene, but Enke was determined to make that impossible. He believed wholeheartedly in his self-proclaimed supercop abilities. The less glamorous truth was that he had taken over Ruth's position when she transferred to the Bartowick police station 2 years ago. Enke was thin and half a head shorter than Ruth. His thinning hair was slicked back, and he wore the casual attire typical of a crime investigator. His wide grin did not bode well. You look really sexy in that uniform, Marks, he greeted her. That's the difference between us, Enke. You'll never look sexy. Same as ever. A look of satisfaction and superiority crossed his face. I hoped that being on patrol would make you a little more tame. Enraged, Ruth stepped toward Enke, but he halted her by placing his flat hand on her chest. She clenched her fists, bracing against him, but he stood firm. Marks. You're trampling all over my crime scene. She wanted to hit him, right then and there. In that moment, she didn't care about potential disciplinary action. Just then, someone from the forensic department called Enke's name. He smiled at Ruth and withdrew his hand. They need me, he said, making a shooing motion. Be a nice girl and watch your step. With that, he left her. Watch your step. What was that arrogant jerk thinking? Just as she turned around and took a step forward, she inadvertently kicked something hard that the snow had concealed. It felt peculiar. She glanced toward the area where the body had been discovered. Halogen headlights illuminated the scene about 10 meters ahead, with Enke trying to look important in the brilliant backlight. Had forensics missed something? Using her boot as a shovel, she freed the object from the snow. It was elongated and stuck in an old rabbit hole, likely just a branch or a root. Nothing to worry about. She crouched down and pulled it out with her gloved fingers. It was a child's shin bone. The ends of the fibula and tibia protruded from the pale flesh. She pulled the stump all the way out. The leg must have been torn from the body with tremendous force. A sock remained attached to the small foot, a faded cartoon character faintly visible on its surface. Through the snow in your socks. God, you must have been so cold, my little one, Ruth thought. Shock washed over her like a rush of cold water. Everything she had suppressed for the past 2 years surged to the surface, gripping her by the throat. Leonie's empty coffin. The tiger duck made of yellow and black cloth, half covered with soil and a few flowers. Marie's bitter look at the grave. Leonie's joyful laugh. Her beautiful face. The scent of summer. Marie sleeping in her arms when life was still good and whole. I will scream. I will scream because it is back. It has found me and caught up with me, and now I'm going crazy. Oh, please, God.
In a daze, she watched Ulbrich vomit violently. That's okay, she thought. She was almost following his example, but only almost. Don't lose control. It won't bring this child back. Leonie won't be returned to you, and Marie doesn't hate you any less. But it's back! It's back! It's all back! She inhaled the cold air. Schmidt approached to help her to her feet. She nodded her thanks, but then her stomach rebelled and she abruptly pulled away, trying to leave the crime scene quickly. Do not contaminate the scene with your DNA. Do not contaminate the scene with your DNA. Do not contaminate. She almost made it. Then, almost gratefully, she felt her stomach contents surge up her throat, sharp and burning like acid. For the first time in 20 years, Ruth Marks vomited at a crime scene. Later that night, Ruth sat in her small office at the Bardowick Police Station. This independent community, located north of Lüneburg, was gradually being absorbed by the city. For now, however, Bardowick maintained its own police station, where Ruth Marks served as chief. The station's interior felt like a relic of the past, resembling the dreamy backdrop of a TV cop show. The detective never advanced in rank, and the deputy had to fetch the patrol car for him. Wooden shelves were stacked high with files, while gray Siemens telephones and old cigarette smoke-stained wanted posters adorned the walls. Some of these posters still featured members of the RAF, long since outdated. The computers were equally antiquated, many donated by colleagues. Ruth pushed aside a pile of current files on her desk and stared at the screen of her personal Apple laptop, illuminated by the dim light of her old metal desk lamp. BYOD, bring your own device, was the latest trend in the business world. But at the Lower Saxony Police, it was a necessary evil for getting the job done. She was familiar with Herbert, the forensic photographer, from previous cases and had convinced him to make copies of the photos taken at the crime scene. In a cruel game of solitaire, she scanned the reduced flood of images displayed on her screen. Clicking on one, she brought up Exhibit 2010-6 from Homicide Case Unknown, file number 2010-38-12-11. The image revealed a single children's sock, size 31, white, with a faded print. Even in a region as idyllic as Lüneburg, crimes against life were occurring. The euphemistic nature of the term had irritated Ruth since she first encountered it at the police academy. Last year, the Lüneburg district recorded 16 attempted murders, six of which resulted in the victim's death. None of those victims were children. 95% of the attempted murders were solved, with the unresolved cases attributed to the State Office of Criminal Investigation taking over two investigations involving suspects outside the district. For a police officer, witnessing a child victimized or killed was particularly heartbreaking. In her 20 years of service, Ruth had seen children struck by trucks, fall from windows, or suffocate in house fires. Thankfully, cases of sexual abuse were relatively rare. However, a child being literally torn to pieces by a perpetrator had yet to occur in Lüneburg's criminal history. Then there were the even rarer cases of children disappearing without a trace. On a Saturday afternoon, just before 4 p.m., Leonie played in the garden of the red brick home she shared with her moms, Marie and Ruth, on the edge of City Park. That year, Leonie was set to start school. She was a bright, cheerful, and uncomplicated little girl. Ruth fondly recalled how she and Marie would sit in the kitchen, watching Leonie at play. Ruth and Marie had been a couple for 6 years, having met at a mutual friend's party where Ruth instantly fell in love with the beautiful, shy, dark-haired Marie. At that time, Ruth had just become a chief inspector, while Marie was finishing her PhD in biology. It took Ruth a few weeks to realize that Marie was a lesbian like herself. Marie had previously been married to her husband, Volker, for 7 years, but he left when Leonie was born to pursue his passion for archaeology in eastern Turkey. After those initial uncertain weeks, it took another 2 months for Ruth and Marie to begin their relationship. For Marie, Ruth was her first girlfriend since her student days. Soon after, the three of them moved into the red house on Udeldzennerstrasse, located across from the higher administrative court and near the MTV sports field. Leonie always pronounced it MTV. As for her, MTV was no longer just an abbreviation for a men's gymnastics club, but rather the name of an aging music station. As Ruth dried the dishes, She looked up and noticed Léonie was no longer visible in the garden. It was a warm, beautiful summer day. Ruth turned to Marie. "Did you see her?" she asked. "She must have gone to the park." The hole in the fence had been on their to-do list for a long time. Marie's tone was calm, but her worried expression told a different story. She was baking a cake, wiping sweat from her brow, with dough stuck to her fingers. "Can you go after her?" Marie asked. Ruth nodded with a smile, pinching some dough from the bowl. "Hey." Years later, Ruth would still reflect on that moment. It had been perfect, pure happiness.
Ruth stepped outside and squeezed through the narrow gap in the fence that separated her yard from the city park. She stood on the sandy path running parallel to the backyards and looked left and right, but there was no sign of Léonie. "Léonie?" she called out. That child was probably in the meadow again. Léonie had become infatuated with Mr. Berger's cocker spaniel, which he often walked in the park. What was its name again? "Hitchcock," shouted a voice from the wide tree-lined lawn before her. Hitchcock, right. Ruth thought it sounded more fitting for a pug as she approached Jürgen Berger, a lecturer in applied cultural studies at Lufana University. Ruth, who had never pursued higher education, held a healthy skepticism toward male academics like him. In her experience, three-quarters of them couldn't find their asses with both hands and a flashlight. Berger certainly fell into that category. Ruth paused, shielding her eyes from the afternoon sun with her hand. Berger, a man in his late 40s, scanned her body. She wore jeans and a simple tank top that revealed her belly, enticing enough for a humanities scholar. She didn't mind his gaze. She'd heard from Marie that Berger's wife had recently left him. "Have you seen Léonie?" Ruth asked, breathless. "No, not today," he replied, his assessment complete. His expression shifted to one of serious concern. "Has she run away?" "She's probably just wandering around, but she knows she must always check in."
"Children," he said, though he had none of his own. "Something's wrong," Ruth muttered under her breath. "Listen, I'll take a walk around the tennis courts and let you know the minute I see her."
"That's very kind of you. Thank you," Ruth replied. "Do you have our number?" she asked.
"I think I have Marie's cell phone number." He checked his own phone. "Yes, I do. Here it is." After saying goodbye, he headed toward the tennis courts. Ruth made her way back to the northern part of the park, known as New City Park, and approached the duck pond. She asked a couple of young mothers who were feeding the ducks with their children if they had seen Léonie. They shook their heads and scrutinized Ruth's casual appearance. "She can't dress properly or take care of a child."
Ruth left them behind and continued walking north.
Ruth first heard the gentle rippling sound of the fountain. Suddenly, Léonie's little face flashed in her mind beneath the water's surface. It had happened before, small children drowning in shallow garden ponds. "She's almost 8. Have a little faith." Still, she ran as fast as she could. The pool measured only about 7 by 5 feet, with a fountain shooting up from its center. At first, Léonie had imagined it was a whale trapped in concrete. Marie and Ruth had spun a bedtime story about the brave Léonie who freed the little whale and rowed it back to its parents in the North Polar Sea. Ruth quickly scanned the shallow water and the rectangular drain in front of it. Nothing. Good. One less thing to worry about. Yet, unease gnawed at her. Léonie hadn't just vanished. How long had she been searching? 5 minutes? 10? Maybe Léonie was already home. She dashed back to the house, but Léonie was not there. Together with Marie, she systematically searched the park and the surrounding area. Still, there was nothing. Marie called Léonie's friends from kindergarten while Ruth alerted her colleagues on patrol to be on the lookout for Léonie. But Léonie Weber had disappeared without a trace.
Ruth first noticed Ulbrich when he cleared his throat, drawing attention to himself. Had she been crying? She quickly checked her cheeks. No, all clear. Peter Ulbrich held 2 steaming mugs of coffee. In the backlight, he could easily be mistaken for a handsome man, tall, well-built, with blonde hair and blue eyes. He quietly handed Ruth one of the mugs, which featured a talking hemp leaf, asking if the user wouldn't like to get high. Ruth looked at Ulbrich, questioning. Oh, this is mine. It's from my buddies. They thought it was funny because I'm a cop and... He trailed off, scratching his head in embarrassment, and glanced at her laptop. Nice one. Ruth nodded and closed her laptop, not wanting Ulbrich to know she had been looking at crime scene photos. Expensive? He asked. Confused, she replied. What? Oh, it's a used one.
Ulbrich nodded, and an awkward pause followed. Finally, he mustered the courage to speak again. I want to apologize again for my behavior earlier. I don't know why I got involved in that stupid bet. She silenced him with a wave of her hand and gestured for him to sit across the table. Blushing, Ulbrich sat down. Apology accepted, she sighed, realizing it was her turn to speak. I also want to formally apologize for attacking you. I overreacted. Sorry. No, you're not. I really deserved it, Ulbrich replied, looking into her eyes with genuine concern. Restart, he asked, extending his hand. Ruth glanced at his hand, then at Ulbrich. Finally, she smiled and shook it. Restart.
Ulbrich looked at the report on Bjorn Eggert's leg that Ruth was about to write. Some shit, huh? We don't get to choose it.
Ulbrich clearly wasn't as clueless as his earlier actions suggested.
Do you have any idea if there were any other clues?
If there were, tonight's snow covered them. This year, of all years, climate change had taken a break in northern Germany. Normally, November in Lüneburg was just a colder version of April, North German dreary weather. But this year, snow had arrived in early November and lingered. The forester found the body while inspecting the deer feeding grounds. He has made his statement. He lightly touched his tongue to the gap in his teeth, took it and sent him home.
You think that's okay with Enki?
Sure. Of course it was fine for Enki not to talk to a witness in person. Enki was an idiot. Did we get any reports of missing children?
No.
The day before yesterday, three boys got lost in the woods near Hitzfeld, but were home a few hours later. Would you do me a favor?
Sure.
Could you check what the colleagues at the homicide division have come up with? Ulbrich hesitated, then nodded.
I think that can be done.
Silence fell again. Ulbrich looked at her questioningly before finally saying,
Okay then.
He stood up, spilling a little coffee from his cup, and pointed at hers.
Keep the cup for now. I mean, as long as you need it.
He was kind of cute, she thought with a grin. Ulbrich left the office. Suddenly, she felt an overwhelming sense of loneliness. Maybe she should call Selina. She was the closest thing Ruth had to a friend. No, you're a big girl. You can do this by yourself. Then the tears finally came. Ruth Marks cried for the dead, unknown child, for the missing Leonie, for her lost love for Marie, and for herself and her struggling life. She cried until her lungs burned, and she had no strength or tears left from exhaustion. Slowly, she began to feel better. She wiped the tears from her face and started to write her report.
Moonlight winding, snow so white, heart is pounding to trees, fear in his eyes, evil stalking under moonlit skies. She's seen this darkness before. Her child beast remains.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about Heinke Digital audiobook podcasts and its author, Christian Heinke, please visit heinke.digital.